Welcome to the Money Saver Podcast. Journalist Ellen Roseman and Canadian Money Saver Editor-in-Chief Lana Sanachar interview leaders in personal finance and investing, as well as top bloggers, authors, and entrepreneurs. The goal is to help you save money and increase your assets. Learn how to make smart choices, safeguard your interests, and protect yourself from poor advice. Brought to you by Canadian Money Saver Magazine.
Thanks to MillionDollarJourney.com for supporting this episode of the Money Saver Podcast. Million Dollar Journey has been helping Canadian DIY investors since 2006. Check out Million Dollar Journey's latest reviews of discount brokerages and robo-advisors, then snag your free Can I Retire Yet ebook. Million Dollar Journey is written exclusively for Canadians by longtime Canadian financial authors.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Money Saver Podcast. Today, we have a guest that I've been trying to get on for a couple of years now, and I'm so glad she's here. It's Carrie Taylor, also known as Squawk Fox. She's got a blog that is well known around the world. She's been blogging for ages and ages, probably, 15 years? Quite a long time. And now she's gotten into podcasting, and she has a TV video network as well. And she is so well known about money, and especially about common sense techniques for managing your money, you know, budgeting. She's got a famous blog article about how if you're broke, it's your own fault. We'll get into that shortly. Welcome, Carrie, and we're so glad you're here today.
Thank you, Ellen. And that's such an old post. That's like the only post I ever wrote with a stern tone. So I think it's funny you picked up on that one. But yeah, if you're broke, it's your own fault. I don't feel that way anymore.
And I just read it recently, and you talked about, well, it might be different if you're a parent, but I'm not a parent. But now you are a parent, so probably you're seeing life from a different angle too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you've been through a kind of rough year or two where you had breast cancer, but you're fine now, at least for now. You just had a bunch of tests, and we want to talk to you about how your views have changed, I guess, or what are your views now coming through COVID and also through this serious illness.
Oh, so, my goodness. Well, yeah. First of all, I don't recommend cancer to anyone. I went on Google and gave it a 0 out of 5. Don't recommend. Totally rude. I want to speak to the manager. But I was really shocked when I was given that diagnosis because I was considered young to have the disease. So it really kind of gave me the notion that everything can be fine one day and a total messy show the next, right? I was the picture of health. I was an athlete. I was fit. And then suddenly I was given a diagnosis of a possible terminal diagnosis. So it really brought home the fact that your health is your wealth. And without that, you really don't have much at all, because no amount of money or notoriety can help you when you're given a really challenging diagnosis.
Yeah. And even though you might not have the terminal diagnosis, the cancer diagnosis means that you're in a regimen that is going to be very involving for the next 3 to 6 months, maybe a year, maybe even longer with the checkups. And it's going to be a time when you're probably not functioning at 100% or even close to it. And it changes your life completely, at least during that intense period.
Yeah, I was in treatment for close to a year. I was in the strange position where I was diagnosed at stage 1A, but because I was diagnosed with the most aggressive form of breast cancer, known as triple negative breast cancer, I had to go through the whole works. So I went through 8 rounds of chemo, 30 rounds of radiation, surgery, and it took the better part of a year. So I think, I wasn't able to work. Some women have to work because their benefits require them to have a job, like in the States. Other women just don't have the finances. So I think what advice I would give to younger women coming out of this, knowing what I know now, is I made some very wise financial choices in my late 30s, early 40s, which set me up to be okay after a year off work, plus now a pandemic. And the first thing I did was I had a really sizable emergency fund. I've been a freelancer for a number of years, and I know the paychecks aren't steady while you're waiting to get paid. And with so many people working the gig economy, you really need to protect yourself by having some money set aside. So that was the first thing I did. The second thing I did was I took out a life insurance policy when my daughter was born. And it's no fun to make a bet against your life. But I knew with a little toddler in tow, my husband might have needed money if something bad happened to me. And the third thing I did was I took out a critical illness policy just before I turned 40. And I thought that was a really scary thing to do because I had no cancer in my family. You know, I wasn't concerned about heart attacks or strokes or anything, but something deep down inside told me that, you know, I should prepare for all scenarios that could happen. And I think a critical illness policy is really necessary for a lot of people because so many people will be struck down by things that they're not anticipating, right? We're all very optimistic about our lives. We're going to be great. We're going to live forever. We're going to have healthy lives. And that's not the case. And my oncologist actually helped me fill out the critical illness policy. And he said, so few people have these and everyone he thinks should have one. So I had, you know, money come to me and that really alleviated a lot of the stress and just allowed me to get through treatment. So I think those are three key things that healthy people should think about: life insurance, critical illness, and keep that emergency fund because you never know when bad things happen to good people.
Also, you had moved from very expensive Toronto to BC to a farm, and I guess your cost of living was lower.
Yes. I'm actually a Torontonian, so I've moved across the country a number of times, and I don't recommend it. It's not super fun. It's a lot of work swapping provinces and healthcare programs that way. But I moved to Toronto when my daughter was really young because I wanted to get back home, right? I brought my husband with me. He's from British Columbia, so we kind of take turns. But I actually moved back just before my breast cancer diagnosis, which I think was really lucky because we have a fully paid for house here in rural BC. So again, that alleviated a lot of the renting stress. But Toronto as a renter is a really tough market. We were paying about $2,500 to $2,800 a month in rent, and that's just for a really basic apartment. And when the housing market went crazy in 2017, we were actually renting a house at the time, and we got speculored evicted because our landlord suddenly wanted to sell to cash in on the hot market. So here we are as a young family in a lurch because there was no housing available. You want to stay close to your kids' school so you don't uproot them completely. So we found it really challenging as a young family to stay in Toronto because it was just the shelter situation was just so touch and go. I actually moved 4 times in 4 years when we lived in Toronto. So I was always packing a box or unpacking a box. And it was a really expensive way to live.
That's tough. Did you have all the health resources you needed in your rural location?
Yes. And I think that was a huge advantage to getting diagnosed quickly. Because as soon as I went into the doctor with a concern, because I had noticed my nipple leaked, I had a breast change, I was tested right away. I'm not sure I would have those quick resources in Ontario, given how I've seen so many cuts over the last couple of years. But the medical care here I received with BC Cancer was incredible. I was basically, after they found I had the most aggressive type of tumor, I was on a surgeon's table a week later getting the lump removed. And I had an appointment with an oncologist 2 weeks later. Like, it moves so quickly here. And I'm just so grateful that I had the opportunity to find the cancer early and to have it taken care of early as well. Right. So I think for young women, when they notice a change, you need to be really, you have to be a strong advocate for yourself when you go to a doctor. I am surprised by how many young women have breast cancer in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And so many of them are turned away by the medical situation. Yeah, because there's a belief that they're too young to have cancer. So, and then they end up having a later stage when it's found. And younger women are more likely to have more aggressive cancers than postmenopausal women. So when I see a young woman with a breast change, I'm like, you have to advocate really strongly in order to get a scan, a mammogram, an ultrasound, a biopsy to get it checked. Because it's just, we're just kind of overlooked because no one believes that young women can get breast cancer.
Yeah. And we're glad to have you back. It's been about a year since you came back from your cancer treatment and you started being active again on social media. I mean, that's
yeah,
your
I, I was so shocked. I kind of hid for a year. Yeah, I hid for a year, and but I'm back now.
Good, good. And you came back just in time for the pandemic and giving out money advice for the pandemic. And do you have any tips for people on how to get through it all? There's been a lot of stories I've found, things about, you know, money that people put down and couldn't get back, deposits of different kinds, and also the CERB, whether you're eligible, whether you're not.
Well, I've mostly looked at interviewing, I've actually been interviewing a lot of behavioral scientists, asking about their opinions about how to deal with the market ups and downs. And I tend to like to look at a behavioral informed approach to money, because I guess the traditional like economics viewpoint assumes that, you know, we handle money like we're robots without emotions. But money is actually very messy because our emotions are what trip us up and get in the way. So I've been finding, by looking at how we humans actually react to money rather than how textbooks say we react to money, has been really helpful. So a more behavioral informed approach to how to deal with stress, how to be more mindful, and that kind of approach. So I think one of the big things I look at these days is opportunity cost. So opportunity cost is something we don't often think about because we make decisions in the here and now, and we don't think about how they affect our future. So an opportunity cost is the trade-off we all make when it comes to money, right? Because money we spend today can't be spent tomorrow. Money we spend on one thing can't be spent on something else. What are the trade-offs? What are the alternatives? So I have like kind of a two-step thought process I go through when I ask people to think about their trade-offs. And the first is, say you're going to buy an expensive winter coat, right? We live in Canada, it gets cold, we need a winter coat. So the first thing is, do you need a winter coat? Is your, you know, other winter coat still serviceable? Is there a less expensive brand you can purchase? Or is there a way that you can decrease the cost by perhaps looking at the secondhand economy, because there's a ton of stuff out there to purchase. So that's just one way of looking at the alternatives to buying a coat. The second is to reframe it. Think about the last time you hit one click purchase on, say, Amazon, and remind yourself, how did that feel? How does it feel to spend money so quickly? And how did you feel when the box came in the mail? Were you happy? Were you disappointed in yourself? Did you feel guilty? Did you stick it in a closet and not want to remember it because of how that felt? So I think by looking at the alternatives to spending money, looking at what else that money could do besides the purchasing power we have, you know, could you put that in an RSP? Could you put that in a tax-free savings account? Could that money go to decreasing debt? And then reframing it by looking at how it felt to actually spend that money. A lot of the times it doesn't feel so good and we feel bad about that choice. So it's a really good way to make more informed, more mindful decisions when we spend.
Yeah. There's so much out there about FOMO, fear of missing out. So you spend in this fear that you got to have it. And then as soon as the box arrives, it's probably like, okay, now what is the other thing I got to get in order not to miss out? And you know, that they call that the hedonic treadmill, and you get trapped in it.
Yeah. Or a lot of the times people forget what they bought, right? Oh, what's in that box? Oh, it's that thing I didn't really need. And there it is. Gee, what an idiot I was for buying it. But it's so easy to do, especially online, because the algorithms target us when we look at something online, and then they target us, and then we see it again and again. And if you see like that thing that you were looking at, say, for me, it's always a kid's pair of shoes. I just get targeted with kid's shoes. My kid is growing like crazy. And it just reminds you that there's those shoes, the ad shows you, and then eventually you give in and you purchase it. Because if you see that touch point about seven times, you become familiar and you buy it. So it's really hard with all this targeting.
They stalk you online with pictures of whatever it is you saw last. And then also they keep sending you emails. If you just bought one thing, they constantly send you emails. So you never stop being a customer unless you turn off those emails and stop being notified. But it takes work.
Well, it's a cue, right? And this is where I look at how habits get made and how financial decisions are decided upon. A lot of the time we get these cues, right? So a cue could be that email blast we get from a retailer. It could be a pop-up ad we get, you know, when we're in Facebook, on Twitter, wherever. And they cue us and they remind us, hey, there's this thing that you were looking at that you want to buy. And then it's so easy to click on it and look at that thing. And then they cue us again with maybe 5%, 10% off. And then the habit is actually going in and spending the money. And then we have to reflect upon that purchase when it comes in the mail. So I think a big way to avoid all this temptation, because willpower is exhausting and it doesn't really work because, you know, we're told we should have more self-control, but it doesn't work because the environment is triggering us to do something that's costing us. So change the environment, Ellen. Like, go in, unsubscribe to all these email blasts, turn off notifications, and absolutely clear cookies in your browser. And when you see that thing pop up on Facebook, know that they're targeting you. Because by changing our environment, we can change the cue so that we don't fall into the habit of spending.
Yeah. You just reminded me of a great article you wrote a few years ago about dynamic pricing. And a lot of people don't realize what that is. Probably if you're making airline reservations, but not many of us are doing that anymore. But the price keeps changing all the time. And they track you and see what you might be willing to spend, and then they'll charge you more. You know, it's not the same price for everybody. So tell us more about how that works.
Oh yeah, dynamic pricing has been out for a while. I first noticed it in my Amazon cart, right? Like, I would look at a book, say it was $25, and then the price would go down to 23, and then it would go up to 27. And it was really kind of like, oh, if I don't buy it now at 23, I'm going to miss out on the best deal, right? So it entices you to jump in and spend the money. But dynamic pricing can work on a number of levels, because retailers have your postal code. They can target you based on where you live. If you live in what's perceived to be a housing area that is worth, that has higher real estate prices, they might try and charge you more. So it's really tough as a consumer to know if you're getting the best and the fairest price, because all the cookies and algorithms that are in our browsers that target us are dictating the price for us. So as a consumer, it's really hard to protect yourself. So you really just need to compare and contrast what the pricing is across other networks, and maybe shop in a different browser than the one that you surf in, so that you give yourself a chance not to be a target. And apps target you differently than web browsing. So check in an app to see if it's a lower price. But it's such a tricky thing as a consumer to deal with now. So it's the rise of the algorithms, I'm afraid.
Right. When you're talking about psychological factors, one that gets to me is loss aversion, because we know that a small loss can be much more hurtful to you than a really big gain. And we have no balance when it comes to that. Loss is always pain. And so there's two different versions of it as an investor. One is that you hold on. The thing can go all the way to zero because you're not ready to give up on your hope that it will get back to your cost price as if it cared. And the other one is that you sell right away because you just can't stand loss. And I've been teaching investing for beginners for a long time. And then there's some people who I know can never be investors because as soon as they have any kind of paper loss, they're just in too much pain. They just can't live through it. And there are times when you have to sit with your red ink and know that it's going to come back because the stock market does, and it usually reaches a new high. But just those days of waiting can make people crazy. And so you're interviewing experts about it. What do they say about loss aversion?
Oh, wow. So like with respect to investing, the biggest advice, a world-renowned behavioral economist named Dan Ariely gave me this advice. He said, don't look at your portfolio. That's it. If you don't look at it, then you're not going to have a feeling of when it's up or down, because the market's going to be up one day and down one day. Like, some portfolios move tens of thousands of dollars in a day. If you're the kind of investor that gets nervous about how your portfolio is dancing around, the best response is not to make that part of your environment. So, it's good that it's best if you're having a balanced portfolio. I'm a big fan of index funds. I have an all-in-one index fund for many of my investments. And I know that it's balanced to my risk preference. So I just don't look. And, during my year off of work, when I was in cancer treatment, I didn't even look at my portfolio once. And I was so surprised when I went back. I didn't know that the markets were doing great. So the best investors are the ones that aren't too invested in their portfolios because they just let it ride.
Yeah. So, and they keep adding more because when you're putting in at a time when the market's down, you're getting more for your money. You know, that's the supermarket shopper's viewpoint. But when it comes to investing, people think, I don't want to invest now. Nobody else is investing now. Well, that's probably the best time.
It is. I mean, we tend to, you know, the textbook economics would say sell high, buy low. But in reality, we buy high and sell low, right? Yeah. So if you take peeking at your portfolio out of the equation, you're going to do better than most investors because you're not constantly eroding your wealth by selling it at the wrong time. So it's really a hard lesson to learn, but I find I'm older now. I've seen the market do a lot of crazy stuff over my lifetime, and I know it's going to come back. So just set your allocation to a comfortable position, work with perhaps an advice-only financial planner, and invest in a balanced portfolio of index funds. And by not paying high fees, you're ahead of most people because you're going to get most from your market returns.
How has your viewpoint on money changed since you became a parent? Your daughter's about 10, maybe?
She's 9. Good memory.
9, okay. and also you were an urban parent and now you're a rural parent and probably things have changed for her quite a lot. And maybe she's not as influenced, if she ever was, by what her friends and school buddies are wearing and doing.
Oh, she's influenced all right. I mean, okay. Already kids her age have cell phones, right?
Oh, yeah.
She's asking me about TikTok and a lot of stuff. So, you know, they're pretty wise to the world. They know what's going on. I don't know if it's osmosis, but, you know, they know what stuff is and they ask for it. So I think whether we live in the city or rural BC, we're all connected somehow. So kids are just, you know, wise. They're so wise. But I think starting her young with an allowance really helped her learn more about money. So I give her a dollar. Well, I used to give her a dollar a week for every year she kept me awake at night. So we started with, you know, we started with like $5 a week. So right now we're at $9. So we do $9 every 2 weeks. And we give her this money with the intention that she makes mistakes with it and she learns from how it feels to have money. We don't tie it to chores like a lot of, like one perspective will, because the idea is we don't tie it to chores because no one in our house earns money from picking up after themselves, right? The whole notion of picking up after yourself is being a good human in this family. So we tie it to just her age. And the idea is we give her the money so she can spend it and learn from it. So there was one time where there was like a small stuffy bunny that she liked. She preferred the big stuffy bunny, but she went and spent her money on the small one. And she felt huge buyer's remorse because she knew if she had waited another couple of weeks, she would have had enough money to buy the big bunny. So this was a very good lesson for her to learn what it feels like to have buyer's remorse, not taking the time to spend for something that you really want, and instead, you know, giving into, I guess, FOMO and buying that smaller item sooner. So she's learning lessons about how it feels to have money, how it feels to spend money, and how it feels to make bad financial decisions. So I think it's working really well. You know, she sometimes buys clothing that I don't want to buy her. She's like, I like this t-shirt. And it's like, I don't love it, you know, but it's her choice. So I let her spend her money and buy it. And it's funny because I see her making emotional, you know, she has emotional feelings to buying stuff. And it's just really good that she's in a safe environment and can learn that at home.
I have an original copy of your book, 397 Ways to Save Money. And it came out in 2009. Yeah, but it stands up pretty well. And what I like about the stuff you do is that you're so practical and so into the nitty gritty. You have a blog post that I refer to a lot about, you know, how to organize your fridge, all that kind of stuff that money people don't always do because they just think, well, that's home ec. But home ec is important, right? And I think that's maybe why your blog, which has been going on for so long, has been so successful because people really relate to the kind of topics. They're applicable to everybody. And do you purposely do that or you just do it because that's the way your mind goes?
Well, home economics is such a huge part of personal finance. And I think kind of the bro culture out there looks at stocks, investing,
yeah,
Bitcoin, right? And they forget that you still got to spend money to live, right? So I started with the whole idea of what can we do around our house, you know, with our money. And it's such a huge part of life. But I think when I started my blog, that was my perspective. Today, I'm moving more into science-backed strategies for investing, saving, spending, that sort of idea. But I started in 2007 before the big market crash. And when the market crashed, suddenly people were looking for ways to save money on food. People needed the basics again, because suddenly so many people were out of work. So it's funny how when the market shifts, how perspectives change to what really matters in life. Sorry. Yeah.
Let me take You did pieces on how to take the famous restaurant foods like McDonald's dishes and recreate them at home and the fraction of the price. And you worked it out really clearly. I have to point out that Carrie has a background as a journalist and as a computer scientist. So together, that makes a pretty good combo.
Yeah. Yeah, no, a lot of people do takeout. We're seeing a lot of certain generations are doing a lot of ordering in. But back then, I just like to cut the cost on really known well meals and show how much money you can actually save by brown bagging it at home. But I think the blog, like those sort of topics have endured over time. Because my voice when I write, it's kind of, I've been described as the good friend that gives you honest advice about money. So I've seen my readership grow over the past 10, 15 years. And a lot of my readers have been with me for over 5-10 years because I have that kind of empathy, and I don't really shame and blame people into the choices they make. I'm like, I really have no skin in the game. I don't care how you spend your money. I just want you to look at the alternatives and to see what the other choices are. And I lay them out. And it's like, you choose, you know, you've earned this money. This is your income. What choice are you going to make? Would you rather make this thing at home and save the money and maybe invest the rest? Or does it bring you joy to go out to restaurants and eat? Because if it gives you joy, then that's great. But just know that there's an alternative and a cost and a trade-off you're making by going out and eating this expensive meal or ordering takeout at McDonald's, by not doing this at home. So it's really just about making the best choices and looking at the alternative decisions that we can make with our money. And I think when I lay out, you know, this costs this versus that costs this, is it worth it? It's about giving people the other option, the other flip of the coin, stuff that they can do and choices they can make with their money.
So tell us about your new podcast and video. I guess you do the video and then the audio goes on the podcast, right? And it's called, you tell me the names.
Oh, it's called the Cash and Carry Podcast. And it's where I explore how to make better financial decisions and how to make better money habits. So my guests and I explore things like saving, spending, investing, and behavioral economics. And it's been really fun. It's a lot of hard work for me because it's a whole new platform. But the podcast is there on anywhere that you can get podcasts. And the video stream of it, so if you want to see my guests, is available on YouTube under the handle of Squawk Fox. And I've only done a few, but it's grown substantially. And I've had hugely positive feedback to it. So it's a lot more fun to do, I guess, audio and video than to always write. So it's nice to have another outlet where I can talk to people and find answers to everyday challenging financial problems.
Okay. And I have to say that it's Cash and Carry, K-E-R-R-Y, instead of Cash and Carry. And tell us how you got the Squawk Fox name.
Oh, Squawk Fox. Oh gosh. So it was like 2007 and I just had an image of a squawk box, right? Like that's
Yeah,
the Squawk Box is a speaker system that was on a trader's desk, and it kind of squawks out all the orders, buy, sell. It's kind of a noisy, annoying thing that traders use. And I thought, well, why would you want to be a box? Why not be a fox, right? Why not squawk about things that actually impacted our lives and make a difference? So I just thought it was a fun play on word, and I never thought it would take off. So now I'm like the professional Squawk Fox, and it was just a ridiculous thing at the time. But I always kind of giggle when I see it's Carrie, the blogger behind Squawk Fox, I giggle when I see that because I still think it's funny. And I think my approach to money sometimes is a little funny. So I think it works. But it was just something fun and a play on word. And it just stuck.
Yeah, it's nice to be known by one name.
I know.
It's like Adele or Madonna.
I've been called a lot of names over the years. So if people just call me Squawk Fox, I'm cool with it. I go by Hey You, whatever works.
Yeah. So when we come out of the pandemic, if we ever do, but when life goes back to something resembling normal, do you think we're going to bring any changes to our thinking and our habits that we learned while stuck at home for so many months?
Oh, it's such a good question. I wish I had a crystal ball and I wish I was clairvoyant, but I've definitely seen a huge shift from cash only payments to digital cash, right?
Like, yeah, I never use cash anymore.
It just, no, neither do I. And the pandemic, because people were afraid that you would get the virus through tangible goods, right? I know when we first got our mail, we would like wash it down and disinfect it because we didn't know then how the virus was transmitted. So I've noticed a lot of retailers don't take cash anymore. They're happy with, you know, digital payments. So, you know, like digital wallets, credit cards, debit cards, all those sort of things. And the challenge with that for consumers is it's easier to spend money when cash is digital because we don't have the pain of paying, right? When we actually hand over $20, it feels like something, right? We're giving away our money. We're handing over our money and it feels painful. Whereas when we make a digital payment, it doesn't feel like much at all. And we don't feel that we've paid the money till we've actually gotten the bill. So, you know, you get your credit card bill and you're like, whoa, what happened to this, right? Where did I spend all that cash? But so we're going from a cashless way of living. We're going from cash to a cashless way of living. And I think consumers need to know that this is going to make spending a lot easier. But at the same regard, even though it causes more spending, it can also help us increase our savings. Because when we are working, you know, with all this digital money, we can create sub-accounts in our checking account, assign goals to them, and automatically transfer the money in to, I guess, protect it against ourselves. And I think that's a positive with digital currency because we can't really do that with cash. You know, I guess people used to put it in jars or jam jars, envelopes, right? So we need to recreate that system for ourselves digitally. And by signing up with a bank that allows you to create sub-accounts for no fee, or to create financial goals within our account and to attain it by automating the money in and seeing that money grow, that's going to help us budget. That can help us reach our any goals that we have. So I think that's a plus of the pandemic, but also we need to just be aware of the downside as well.
Yeah. And I think people who weren't really into online commerce have gotten much more into it, getting more comfortable with it. But on the other hand, like your daughter, they're learning about how sometimes returns can be really, really difficult. And you think that, you know, obviously it doesn't work. You send it back. They might not take your money back or they might charge you to send it back. And you have to be really careful about the online retailers you deal with because some of them don't really deal with the customers that fairly. And then on the other hand, we're spending less because we're not buying clothes as much. We're not going out as much. We're not getting our hair done. We're not getting our nails done. But are we using that money to buy online more often, especially when they, as we were talking before, get their nails into you by following you around and suggesting things to you?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Like I just know when we first went into lockdown, how all the people on TV suddenly showed their roots. Right? It's the first time I've ever seen roots. So I think we're okay these days with showing a lot more imperfection, right? Women aren't really doing their makeup. I mean, you and I joked pre-interview, I'm like, should we wear makeup? Right? Because it's not as important as it felt before, right?
Yeah.
So whether people go back into the marketplace to do all the stuff we did, to do all the beauty routines, or, you know, maybe we're not as concerned about that as we were before, right? We were afraid for our families getting sick. We're afraid for ourselves getting sick. it gives us a different perspective of what life can look like outside of the glamour and gloss, right? So that's one perspective. But I don't know, I think there's a lot of pent up demand for people to get out and see each other again. We really want to socialize. We're social beings, right? I mean, I miss hugging people. I miss going out for coffee with people. I miss having dinners with people. These are all things that cost money. But I think it's also the experience. So when we come out of the pandemic, it might be a huge benefit to look at how stuff feels when we buy it and how much happier we are when we spend money on experiences. Because science shows that those who spend money on experiences are happier, healthier, and wealthier people than those that just keep buying stuff, right? Because the stuff doesn't really fill the void. So I say when we get out of the pandemic time, look at spending your money on what makes you happy and experiencing things and events with people you care for and love, because I think that'll bring us the most happiness, especially coming out of the situation where we've been in isolation for so long.
And back to travel, but not necessarily, you know, going across the world, just maybe scouting out different things in your neighborhood or in your city or going across Canada. Because I think we're all realizing now that we're confined that there are many great things just around us. I take my husband through places in the neighborhood. He'd say, I didn't know this was here, because he didn't take walks around much. But now that's our activity.
Yeah, I follow you on Instagram and I see you photographing a lot of interesting architecture, right? And it's fun to stop and pause and see what's in your own backyard, because exploration, you know, is can bring us joy. So
yeah, I follow you on Instagram and I see you're in fields and you're discovering things in the field, and then there's vehicles of different kinds that you hop on and off.
Yeah, I know, tractors and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm always on a tractor every now and then. Yeah. So, you know, I think when we come out of lockdown, I think spending our money and our resources on experiences and looking around and getting out and hugging people again, I think that's really where it's at. That's where we find the most joy. Yes. So if you've got some money, put it towards there. If you're one of the many people struggling because you're out of work, that's a whole different story. I feel like the pandemic has painted two very different pictures. People that, you know, were able to save a lot of money because they're not traveling or they don't have to spend money on the subway to get to work. And then there's another group of people that have been out of work. So I think it's kind of the tale of two quarantines, right? It's such a diverse picture of what's happening there.
What I'm noticing now on social media is a lot of videos and pictures of people hugging after so long. You know, the grandparents have got the vaccine. They're finally able to hug their family. And they're so comforting and so warm. And no matter what income group you are, you can always, you know, get a joy out of hugs and closer relationships with the family members that you've been apart from for so long.
Yeah, my father-in-law is 87 and we just booked him to get a vaccine. So we're so excited because he hasn't really seen his grandchildren in a year now.
Yeah.
So I can't wait. I mean, we didn't have him over for Christmas because you can't. So we delivered Christmas dinner to him on his porch, you know, and I just feel for the seniors because it's so isolating and so lonely because we don't want to kill them, right? Like, it's like, I love you. I'm going to leave you alone for a year. Have fun with that. It's awful. So I'm so excited to start seeing Canadians getting vaccinated, and we're booking, you know, times to get our parents vaccinated. So I can't wait till this is done. I mean, I've been locked in my house since 2019. So yeah. I'm really stirred.
As long as everyone else.
I know, I'm almost at 2 years this. So I feel shell-shocked sometimes when I even just leave the house, because it's just, I've been doing this for so long. So
right.
I hear you people, it feels awful. Let's get out and have a cup of coffee and enjoy a crowd. I miss crowds.
But there's something about a crisis that brings you back to your basic values. You know, like, who are you? What do you believe in? What makes you happy? What doesn't make you happy? It's sometimes easier to edit what you want after going through this. For you, what are like the basic principles that you operate on as a person and as a kind of a person who wants to make best use of their money and their resources for their entire life?
Well, time is more important than anything. I think we don't value our time enough. I think choosing what to say yes and no to.
It's like money, you know, once you spend your time, it's gone and you can't get it back.
You can't get it back, right? I think looking around you and it's the relationships with people. It's the time you spent with the people you love and care for. And it's time. Time is more important than anything else. And I think as soon as I learned that my health was at risk, I didn't want more money. I wanted more time. So I think that principle and understanding the value of our time can help us spend our time in more meaningful ways.
Have you become more mindful?
More mindful. And that can bring us happier, and it can actually make us wealthier too, because when you spend time with people you care about doing things that you do, working on projects or work that fires your engine, that brings you joy, we're wealthier for it. So I think that is what a major crisis like the pandemic or a challenging diagnosis can bring to us, because it puts in perspective what really matters in life. And it's not money. And, you know, it's funny when I say that out loud, being a personal finance journalist, money isn't the most important thing. It's a housekeeping item, because without money, you can't keep your house. But after a certain amount of income, having more isn't going to bring you more joy, right? It's the relationships you have with those that you care and love.
Yeah. And also the fact that many people have little income, but they manage it really well. And they even manage to give to charity. And so it's not a matter of if tomorrow I make more money, I'll be happier. You know, they can be really happy. And it's just a question of taking it seriously and not throwing it away, or just thinking that you can make it up later, because it's hard to make up for those mistakes.
Mm-hmm. No, I find when I've worked with people with cash flow challenges or lower income families, I found that they're the best budgeters out there, right? They know what to do with every single dollar they make. And these families tend to be the most generous there are. You don't have to tell them, I'm like, you can't keep donating to charity, right? You need to have an emergency fund yourself. But it's true. I find the most generous people tend to have the least financial resources, but they have, they just find so much joy in sharing what they have. So it's a really different perspective between, you know, higher income families and more cash strapped families. So it's a lesson to learn there, but it's true. More doesn't make you happier. More stuff won't make you happier.
What's ahead for you? I see that you're starting, or you're doing the financial planning designation, one of them.
Yes. So I'm almost done studying for the CF, the Certified Financial Planner exam, level one, which they now renamed to the QAFP. I only have one course left. So right. I've been doing that in quarantine and studying a whole bunch. And it was really eye-opening. It was a lot of, it's a lot of work, but it's really eye-opening to see how financial planners are educated. And it's really interesting as well from a journalism's perspective, because it gives me so much more insight to how those with a certified designation think. It's a completely different world than how I've been thinking. So, but I've learned a lot about pensions. And I'm like, what's a pension? I don't know many people with a pension, but apparently there are Canadians with pensions. So I thought that was really interesting.
It's a generational thing.
I think it's a generational thing. I'm like, yeah, I'm not meeting too many millennials or Gen Xers with a pension, but hey, it's nice to learn about defined pension programs. That would have been nice.
Great. Well, from one pensioner to Gen X. It's really fun being friends all these years and following your progress. And I hope that things will be on the up and up from now on, and that you continue to weave your magic, making personal finance fun and sexy. Do you still say that in your editorials?
Sexy, delicious, and fun?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? I think money should be delicious. You know, it should be sexy and it should be fun. I find too many families don't talk about money. Too many people are shy about it, but I'm finding the younger generations are a lot more vocal. So when they speak up, it makes me happy, especially women looking for pay equality, closing the gender pay gap. So I think these conversations are necessary, but I still love that tagline. It stuck for years, it still works. And I'm good with that.
The other thing that's distinctive is that you always say love, love, love. So you're a bundle of love towards your readers, and that's great. Anyway, it's been really fun talking to you, Carrie, and best of luck.
Thank you, Ellen.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I'm Ellen Roseman. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next exciting edition of this podcast. And if you like this podcast, please go to iTunes and subscribe and leave us a review as well. That will help us keep this helpful information coming your way.